You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are
Rachel Jackson, rabbi in Hendersonville, North Carolina, and my favorite number is 49.
Ian Benz, associate professor of elementary science education at UNC Charlotte, and my favorite number is 7.
Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania. My favorite number is 3.
Kendra Holt Moore at Boston University in Boston, Massachusetts. PhD student, and my favorite number is also 3.
You know, it's funny. All of us have very biblical numbers except for the rabbi.
Oh, that's so interesting that you say that, Zach. 49 is a completely biblical number.
Oh, wait.
Can I guess what it is?
Please do, Kendra.
Is it?
Please do.
Because 7 is like the perfect number, typically. But if you multiply 7 by 7, it's like multiplying perfection by perfection.
Yes, it's the Jubilee. It's the year of Jubilee is the 49th year.
It's actually the 50th year.
50th year. Well, yeah.
But that's really important because it is exactly 7 of 7. And then what comes next? And the idea is that we humans can only experience just below perfection. And there's this sort of mystical idea that Moses, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu, the Moses of the Bible, right? The 5 books of Moses, that guy, he was so righteous and so learned and so spiritually in touch with God. And that there are 50 levels of ascension, and he only got to level 49.
Interesting.
So for me, it's 7 of 7, but then it's also this concept of valuing not perfection. Right? That there is something inherent that we are meant to be not perfect. And I just love that. And then from a mathematical perspective, because math is cool.
Mm-hmm. Stay in school, kids.
That it is.
That's right. You can take the square root of 49, obviously get 7. But then you can take the square root of each of the digits inside the number 49. So you can take the square of 4 and the square of 9, which is fun. And then for a whole nother twist, and maybe there's a mathematician out there that can tell me why this happens, but if you take the absolute value of 4 minus 9, you get 5, and then take their the square roots of those, 2 and 3, and add them, you also get 5.
Whoa.
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 I had no idea that this episode would be so deep. But I love thinking of things like that. So that's actually really interesting.
Wow. That's like a Keanu Reeves level of whoa right there. Yeah.
Whoa. I feel like I'm in the Matrix.
Huh.
You are the Matrix.
Humans are so good at finding patterns, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. And I think that's right. So we're talking about these things. And one of the reasons that I thought numbers would be an amazing way to start today is because numbers seem on the surface so clear and cut and dry and non-questionable. And yet, when we go just a little bit below the surface, we recognize that, nope, there's way more into it than could ever be possible. There's so many different layers that we can think of. So in that example of 49, there's lots of different ways that we can even look at that number, many of which I didn't even talk about. Just because it's my favorite number doesn't mean that it's your favorite number. So in this way, I believe that religion and spirituality also have that similar thread, that on the surface, it gives us something and we can say, ah, yes, this is what I uphold. This is what I love. And the deeper and deeper we go into it, whether it's our own traditions or one that we, to use a modern understanding, have holy envy towards, we can see the depth and the beauty in those religions, just like we can with numbers. So in that vein, I would love to hear some stories from each of us talking about, in your religious and spiritual identity, and for our own edification, let me clarify the definitions of those as I'm using them, and I realize that we all use them differently. So I'm using religion and spiritual identity as a way of indicating a connection to an established tradition, a connection to a broader set of people and their values to which you ascribe. And this is different to me than, say, faith, which can be very personal, individual, and theologically based. And so that's how I'm using the difference. So in the vein of religion or spiritual identity, if you were to walk somebody through your museum, you say, "This, I want you to know about me. Read this little plaque. See this artifact. What's in your museum, Zach?"
I mean, are these things that are from my life, or can I like steal things from other museums? Like,
well, given that that's how actual museums work.
Well played.
Sometimes
looking at you, Bible Museum.
Sometimes they're more polite and they say, "We have borrowed this," and give acknowledgement that the display that you're seeing is not actually theirs. And sometimes they don't give said acknowledgement. So I think however you would like to structure your museum, we would love to see it.
Rachel, would you mind starting us so I can get kind of a feel about where the question's going?
That's what I was going to ask too.
Sure.
I'll take a crack at it.
Excellent. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Do you mind if I interrupt, Rachel?
Not at all. No such thing as interruption here.
So if I'm way off on what you're thinking, just tell me. So I'm picturing my museum in my brain, thinking about what it would be if you were walking into my mind, which some people could say is kind of scary, but whatever. I think
just turn the lights on for us.
Yeah, that ka-ching. The very first thing that I think you would see is obviously a plaque describing about what it is you're going to experience. And I think it would, so if it was describing who I am right now and where I am in my spiritual journey, it would talk about you're going to experience someone who's in a moment of flux, of exploration. And so with the idea, I feel this could be an interactive museum. So things, as you walk through, things may change based on where you are and what you see. So I think the perspective, just like in a normal museum, each person's perspective would influence what it is that they see in this museum of mine. But I would want them to understand right away that you are going to experience someone who is on a path of exploration when it comes to my spiritual journey.
So like a Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, moving hedges kind of a situation?
That's actually a good analogy. Yeah, something that I would not be able to accurately describe right now what the end of that museum experience looks like, because I am on it right now. So I think you would see lots of different imagery of experiences in my life, different things that I hold to value right now that I didn't before. Or are you looking for more specifics?
I had an open-ended question.
Good.
So however we understand it, right? The concept of museum is not necessarily a static definition. There is not one type of museum. So I think, right, I'm picturing sort of being on a moving walkway as you're saying that, right?
Yes. That's a good way to look
picturing
at it.
With unknown where it's going to lead you, right? In some of the modern installments in places of exhibits, they actually intentionally use fake walls to guide a person so such that they can't see the end.
I like
that's what I was picturing there. And, you know, for me, my museum has a combination, a very eclectic, I should say very, an eclectic setup where you recognize the wrestling. So I would say that the first pieces that you would interact with would be Jacob's Ladder, right? That fun carnival game where you're supposed to use both your arms and your legs to ascend a wobbly ladder. And that references the biblical idea that Jacob had a dream of angels going up and coming down. And I really love that angels were going up and then coming down, because there's often this idea that angels come down. And so that it's flipped on its head there, I think, is really important to give us that understanding. And then also another piece from Jacob's story. I happen to love Jacob's story, the biblical character Jacob. And that might also be because my maiden name was Jacob. I'm just saying. But there's this other part where Jacob is wrestling with something, wrestling with man, wrestling with an angel, wrestling with God. The Hebrew is unclear, and the commentators have had a field day with it. But at that point, Jacob, at the very end of it, Jacob says, "Before you leave me, you must bless me." And this entity blesses Jacob with a new name and says, "Yisrael, one who struggles with God." And I think that that is the essence of my museum, that throughout these different places, that's what I would see. So what does it mean to wrestle with? What does it mean to have God? And how is that then manifested itself? So, of course, there's going to be the picture that, the God reaching out and trying to touch humanity, one of the most famous Renaissance pictures of old white guy God with amazing six-pack abs. and what does that, what does that God look like? And what does it mean to wrestle with God inside a religious tradition, which I might then disagree with, right? Do I believe in an interventionist God? Inside my religion of Judaism, there's this part of that says, blessed is God who revives the dead. And so if I recite that prayer inside community, inside my religious tradition, what does that actually mean for me? Right. And so that for me is the wrestling piece. But I would, as people are walking through this fake museum, it would show that struggle. And in every struggle, there is hope. And in every struggle, there is respite. And there is deep, profound connection. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a struggle.
So I think I have one. Having listened to you all and just changing the narrative around in my head and imagining what it would be like to walk into my spiritual journey. And I think I get this image of the main lobby in the Philadelphia Art Museum with gigantic columns and a huge ceiling, and everything is made out of marble, and it feels old and well established and strong, and that somebody who made it knew what they were doing. And you walk in, you get in line, you wait your turn, you check your coat, and somebody hands you a pair of headphones, and there's a guided tour. And the voice over the headphones tells you what you're supposed to be looking at next and what you're supposed to be getting from it. And there are various historical artifacts throughout. There's plenty in there from ancient Greece. There's a whole bunch of things from ancient Egypt. There's a whole lot of artifacts stolen from the Holy Lands, but they weren't using them anyway, right? So, and then the further you get through the guided tour, the more jumbled the voice gets, almost staticky, that it gets harder and harder to hear it. And the lights get a little dimmer and a little dimmer the further in you get. And the artifacts that you find are a little less and less compelling. And you're really not sure why you're going to continue this tour. And you think maybe you want to just go back to the gift shop where there's, you know, $10 representations of this art you can barely see that you can take home and put on your fridge. But if you keep going through the tour, eventually the voice just cuts out entirely and you can just put the headphones somewhere else. And you reach another office where somebody hands you a helmet with a light on it and opens up a door to a cavern that is under the museum. And they give you a rope and a flashlight and a rock pick. And they say, all right, good luck. Here's a general map of the first couple of rooms of this place that we've discovered. There's some pretty well-explored places that you can go find for yourself. There are also thousands of tunnels that nobody has gone down before. Feel free to go and explore however long you want, for as much as you want. Feel free to take any pictures along the way. If you find anything really interesting, please, by all means, show us the picture and show us on your map how you got there so that we can get there too and add that to our tour. But for the rest of your stay, just be safe and go. Because growing up fundamentalist, I feel like I had the right interpretation. I had the right answers. My religion was just so secure, so safe, so built on a strong foundation. And I was perfectly happy to listen to other people tell me the history of the ancient world, and which I love, love, love the ancient Mediterranean world. To learn about the history of the church and the history of the faith and just all of that. And I was just content to hear that recorded voice, that, you know, Sigourney Weaver's calm voice over the headphones telling me more about these artifacts. But the older I got, the less compelling it was, and the less I really got from it, the less I really saw in it. And even those old artifacts that meant so much to me before didn't really do it for me. And I really wanted that back. I wanted the safety of fundamentalism back. I wanted not to see the art on the wall in all of its splendor and majesty. I wanted to see it on a postcard that I could take home and look at when I wanted to and needed to. But I kept going and I kept pushing, and it got darker and darker and darker. And then when it got darkest and my whole faith was gone, and I admitted once and for all that I was actually, you know, functionally an atheist, and I lost all of my faith and admitted that I barely had any to begin with, and I took the headphones off and let go of that pre-recorded voice, I discovered a spirituality based on exploration, on a strong faith that says you can't get lost as long as you keep seeking, that it's okay to press into the mystery, and it's okay for the mystery to press back and to enter into a period of life where you don't know where it's going to end up, where you don't know the answers before you ask the questions, where you might lose everything. You might get lost, but you also might find the most incredible cavern that nobody's been to before, where there are species of fish that no one has ever experienced before, where there is bioluminescence where there shouldn't be bioluminescence, where there's stalactites and stalagmites and buried treasure that nobody has seen before that you would have never found up in the museum, but you would only find when you are willing to take the risk and put on your crash helmet and grab your rock pick and go spelunking. So I'm kind of a spiritual spelunker now.
That can be your new tagline.
I'll put that on my business card. Reverend Jackson. Reverend Zachary Jackson, spiritual spelunker.
It's good alliteration, like too. Yeah.
So, Kendra, you've heard now three very distinct understandings. And what would you like to add to our conversation?
So I was recently talking to a friend about the time I visited Ireland as an undergraduate student for a couple of weeks, and it was a class on Celtic spiritualities, and we learned contemplative prayer. So I say that to kind of set up like why I'm about to say the things I'm going to say. So let me try to paint a picture of my museum, which I think would be you'd walk up and maybe see a giant hedge of trees. And in between those trees, you'd see an old brick wall. But the brick wall is stuffed in between the cracks of this hedge of trees, and there's a door. And you can walk into this door, and then it locks behind you, and it's a horror movie, and this is all just not a museum. Just kidding.
I'm not going to your museum. Like, I'm out.
I'm just setting up a Saw scene. Okay, just kidding. So you walk through the door, and it opens into a clearing. So it's kind of this illusion that you're like maybe going into a building, but it's just a threshold into a space where my museum, we can call it, would be. So on the other side of the door then would be a giant prayer labyrinth. And I know those can look very different, but if you've never seen one before, the prayer labyrinth that I'm thinking is just a giant spiral that's carved into the ground. And sometimes these spirals are just one single spiral that just keeps expanding outward and outward. Or if you're starting on the outside, you might be going towards the center. Sometimes these spirals, you might start in one corner, but the spirals are connected. Like one prayer labyrinth might be three interconnected spirals that meet in the center, and you have to walk through each of the three spirals to get to the very end of this collective path. But yeah, so I imagine that if you walk in, you would see something like that on the ground. And I would probably say it's a giant spiral that is maybe composed of three. And it would be one of those minimalist museums where you're kind of frustrated because there's not as many plaques as you were hoping there would be. Like you want to know what's going on, and you feel like a little bit confused, and you're like, where are the acknowledgments to what, like, what is going on here? Is this trying to be some like hip, cool museum? But you would just start walking down the prayer labyrinth, and along the way you would maybe see people stopping and looking at the ground. And on the ground, you would maybe see poetry. And for those who have never done a kind of prayer labyrinth, one of the features of many prayer labyrinths is to see along the path that you're walking, words on plaques carved, or words on plaques set in the spiral, or words carved into the ground, depending if you're walking on concrete or grass. But this is often a guide for people as they walk the path, and it indicates something that you should maybe contemplate as you walk. And so I imagine in my spiral labyrinth, you would see poems that have been really important to me, books that have been really transformative. So like maybe one poem you would see is a Robert Frost poem called Walking Through Woods on a Snowy Evening. And that would be carved into the grass. And so you would maybe read that and then stand there for a minute and think about what it means. But again, you have no plaque cards telling you what it's supposed to mean. So you still feel confused and frustrated, but you just figure it out and you keep walking. And then I think you get to the end and you realize that from the entrance, you have started somewhere that was narrow and have ended somewhere that's very open and expansive. And so if you were looking overhead at what is happening on the ground, you would maybe see people walking into this museum and they're spiraling outwards. So they're opening up, expanding. And I think that would be kind of the gist of the image in my head, is one of expansion and exploration. It's very similar, I think, to the theme of Zach's museum, but it's one along the way that has been, it's hard and confusing sometimes, but it's also exciting and you learn new things along the way and you end up somewhere that's really beautiful and new and open. And it's not a horror movie. Like, you get to go back through the door if you really want to. So don't worry about that.
Okay, good. I was a little worried.
Well, this has been fascinating to take these journeys with each of you. And I hope any of our listeners would also like to share their ideas, share what's in or what structure your museum looks like. When I've been listening, one of the threads that I hear is wandering and acceptance of the unknown and unknowingness. And that's okay, that we are explorers and that we are on a continuous journey, right? That's what I hear in each of ours, that there might have been a starting point, but that doesn't define us. And that is, I think, very important when people look at us. So when we say, what is your religious or spiritual identity? We can say, well, I choose to answer this for where I am now, not necessarily where I was. And we can also say, I choose to answer this for where I hope to be. So for me, I've been Jewish my whole life, but that word has, and that understanding has changed dramatically since I understood that I was Jewish. And I hope it continues to change. I hope I continue to feel that depth of, I am a Jew and so proud of that. And I still need to know what that means. I still, what does it mean to be within inside the religious community to which I aspire and to which I hope to lead, right? In my own way. What does Judaism then look like to me? But I still have identified as a Jew and as Jewish. Not Jew hyphen ish, just Jewish.
Like a little bit Jew.
A little bit Jew.
Jewish.
Jewish. which, welcome on board, Ian.
Yeah, I really wish that people could see our facial expressions at times because it just makes it so much better.
Yeah. But that's why we have wonderful abilities to express ourselves with words.
Yes.
And to let people know that what we're seeing that we can include others in. And so that for me is my religious identity, and how I choose to express that to y'all right now. So as a fellow North Carolinian, how would you express and say what you're Jewish, your religious identity is at this point, Ian?
Well, so I am a member of an Episcopal church in Charlotte. So I'm part of the Episcopal community. It's, I think I, not, you know, I became part of this community just because of my dad. You know, my parents divorced when I was only 8. So each time I would come and see my dad in the summers, the church we went to was an Episcopal church. So that's just what I, you know, I think like a lot of people, you know, they kind of stick to what their family did. And then as I grew older and went into college, my first year I stayed away from the Episcopal campus ministry thinking I didn't want to be a part of it. And then it was my second year I reached out to them, partly because I wanted that sense of community. I think that's what keeps me going to the church I go to now, is that sense of community. And, you know, I've written about that, talked about it, and found that community to be very open and just accepting and inquisitive, you know, all things that I value. Was just excited about the people I got to meet, and being a member of that community led to me meeting my now wife just a few years later. So, you know, we just have always, and she's a cradle Episcopalian is what they're called. So she's from birth, has been an Episcopalian. And it's just a community that we're both very proud to be members of. you know, we know that there are obviously always skeletons in the closet when it comes to any community. But I feel like it's the one that is most accepting of me and what I hold dear in the work I do, especially with science and religion. That they just openly invite my questioning for the most part. And I, you know, love getting to talk with you more, Rachel, because of, you know, a few weeks ago when you and I were on a call before anyone else, you know, and I asked you about any the similarities or that I perceived between the Jewish traditions and the Episcopal community, and that there were some similarities there when it came to that level of inquisitiveness. That really was something I was kind of picking up on, what was excited about.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's wonderful that that you have a place of community in your home. I'll move over to Kendra. How would you say your religious or spiritual identity is today, or actually in any way, today or tomorrow?
So I grew up Baptist, always went to Baptist churches growing up and in college. And now in Boston, I attend a church that is actually a tri-denominational church. So it is American Baptist, United Church of Christ, and United Methodist.
Wow. That's
fantastic. It's kind of interesting.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah. So the church I attend in Boston is a tri-denominational church. And the three denominations are American Baptist, which I didn't even know was a Baptist denomination until I moved to Boston. United Church of Christ,
which is
not to be
now.
Confused with Church of Christ, and United Methodist.
Which is where I was a youth minister. So this church is like my entire faith journey.
Zach.
Wow.
And that one building is Zach.
Yeah. So I think what happens is a lot of churches, especially in the New England area, their congregations can be very small. And so these three denominations, they combined into one building because they each had really small congregations. And just it's hard to survive as a church community when you have like so few people, but you have to maintain the building and, you know, all the costs that come with that. So they combined into this one church. And
what's the name of it?
United Parish in Brookline.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
And yeah, it is a very lovely place. It's very different than some of my church experience, or than most of my church experiences growing up, because the churches I attended as a kid and teenager and even college student usually had pretty large youth groups or college groups, just like a lot of young people. And this church is it's a little more of an older church. There are still kids, but it's just much smaller than what I had experienced early on in life. And so I think it's fun for me as late 20s person to be in a church like this, where I think a lot of my relationships are with people. It feels more intergenerational to my other experiences, which I think is really cool. And yeah, I have been at this church for most of the time that I've been living in Boston. And it's very different from, you know, my Texas churches, but I really love it and has been a really amazing community to be a part of.
So I have to interrupt real quick. I'm sorry. I looked this place up because it sounds fascinating and I want to read more about it. But in looking it up, just noticed something about down at the bottom of their website, talked about milestones in our faith, spiraling through doubt and faith, a blog post from the, I guess, the pastor or whatever he's called. And it starts off with, about 5 years ago, the young couple came into our midst after relocating to Boston from Texas to study theology. And then a little bit further down,
I think Kendra, I know who that is.
Chad Moore.
Aha.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I knew her before I read that.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. I gave the homily this last week, so that's why I'm on the front page. Yeah, our summer congregation is always a little bit smaller because people are traveling in the summer. And so our pastor, Kent French, he always asks people in the congregation to be more involved in the summer. So instead of him doing most of the preaching, you have a lot of people sharing, and it's like a little bit more interactive, which is kind of fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
No, now I'm looking at
it. It's good to know. I think that's great. And if anyone else wants to check it out, we'll have it in our show notes, the link to that and any other churches that or faith organizations that we speak about of interest. And so, Zach, I'll turn over to you as another clergy member who has had quite the journey.
You know, having been a part of all three of those denominations, I was secretly hoping that I knew someone on the staff, but I don't.
Aw.
I know. Oh, well.
Not yet.
Not yet. Not until I visit Boston and come to your church.
Yeah, I've got to come up now. Yeah. Even more reason.
So we could probably do an entire episode on just my own religious / spiritual / faith / whatever journey. So we won't. Suffice it to say that I've been all over the Protestant Christian world. I grew up in a Baptist church, but we were more Bapticostal. I went to an Assemblies of God school, which is very, very Pentecostal, like 2-3 hour long services with people speaking in tongues and falling on the floor and, you know, the sorts of things you see on the television. That's what I was raised in, fundamentalist and proud of it. And I've just been on this long, long journey to find a church home, to find a place where people did Christianity in a way that resonated with me, I think is maybe the way that I can describe that. Because to me, religion and spirituality are distinct things that interact, they intertwine. They're like a Venn diagram, but they're not the same thing. Religion is the scaffolding on which I can explore my faith. It's the headlamp to my spelunking kit. And my spelunking, my spiritual spelunking, is my spiritual life that it's often informed by, and that is where I fellowship with people and worship with others and allow those long-standing traditions to help inform my spirituality, but not to dictate it anymore, not to have the headphones on anymore listening to Sigourney Weaver tell me about my museum. We've watched a lot of Finding Dory on Netflix, so I hear Sigourney Weaver in my head sometimes. I am currently a United Church of Christ pastor, and the UCC is such a fun hodgepodge denomination. We are a united and uniting church that has no idea what that means. What it means in my context is, as somebody said to me at one point, they said, "My friend told me I should come to your church because you'll take anyone." And I said, "Well, that's the best compliment I've ever received." And yes, we built. They took me, this like evangelical / rolling with the Mennonites at one point guy who had never been to the UCC. They took me in, and you know, they felt the stirring of the Spirit as I did, something that has informed my spirituality from growing up Pentecostal is that. Attuneness to the moving of the Spirit, the mystery of that, whatever you call that holy nudge. And so I think of myself now religiously as a United Church of Christ pastor. I serve in this context in southeastern Pennsylvania in this particular tradition of this particular corner of this very particular and peculiar denomination of Protestant Christianity, a very narrow focus. But my spirituality, as I see myself as a scientifically minded Christian mystic, in that I embrace and actively look for mystery. And I acknowledged at some point that at the basis of all religion, all established religion, was someone's mystical experience at some point or another. And all of the historical, logical, philosophical trappings that come along with religion after it's been established for a while, that are the things built around the scaffolding, all of those still rely on, you know, some dude who went up a mountain and heard the voice of God and came down with a story. And then other people who heard that story, maybe they had lesser experiences connected to that story. And then those who worship according to that story also felt a spiritual connection, maybe not as strong as the first, maybe more strong. Usually when it's a lot stronger, then you get end up with a new sect or a new religion or someone else who has a new revelation. But it always has to come down to that experiential piece of divine revelation, of some kind of mystical, ineffable, unexplainable connection to something that is beyond who I am. The most spiritual place in the world for me, and I want to say something like a quiet sanctuary or the top of a mountain or a forest or something that like other Christians say that something sounds super spiritual, right? Yeah. Like I want to do that. But the most spiritual place for me is there's a float spa not too far from me. And I'll put a link in the show notes, because if you live near the East Coast Float Spa and you tell them that I sent you, every four people that go, I get a free float. So it's a sensory float deprivation spa.
I've always wanted to do that.
Yeah. So it's not like the tank, the sensory deprivation tank.
Oh, okay.
Don't think like Stranger Things or the original Daredevil movie. Think like a spa. So you go into this place and
there is one here in Charlotte.
Oh, you gotta go. So you go into this enclosed room. You're all by yourself. The water that you get into is shallow, but it has like 10,000 pounds of Epsom salt dissolved into it. So you float like you're on the Dead Sea. So you can't sink no matter what you do. The water is kept at 92 degrees, as is the air, the skin temperature. You put in earplugs. And then once you're settled and you lay down in the water, the lights go out. And it's a soundproof room. And so you're not able to see a thing. You're not able to hear a thing. You're floating, so you don't feel gravity. And both the air and the water are the same temperature as your skin. And so suddenly you can't feel your touch. Your sense of self disappears. And for some people, it's terrifying. And it feels like torture. And they can't wait to get out. For me, it's like going from zero to Buddha in 60 seconds. I love it. It's like instant transcendental meditation where I can immediately just leave the self and for an hour be completely disconnected and achieve that higher state of meditation that I have such a hard time with in my life otherwise, because I'm so easily distracted. But when I've already paid for an hour, I'm going to be in here for an hour until the blue light comes on. So I'm just going to be here. And I'll tell you that the spiritual experiences, the mystical experiences that I've had in those places, that feeling of transcendence, of oneness with myself, with the universe, with all of existence, with my fellow human, with the rocks and the trees and the birds and the bees, is something that I cannot just teach someone. Someone has to go and experience. So I would love that St. Francis and later Mother Teresa, when people would ask them to explain their spiritual practice, they would simply say, come and see. come and see, come and taste it, come and experience it yourself. I can't tell you what it's going to be like. I can't explain this to you. You have to just feel it in whatever way that your mind can feel and experience this. You just have to do it.
There's a very big difference between reading and listening and doing.
Yeah, like I read all kinds of Christian mystics and I love them. But a lot of their visions and a lot of their practices just seem bonkers to me. And I'm okay with that. And it's, you know, I'm not the kind of guy who's gonna, you know, have crystals in my office that I charge under the full moon. And I'm not gonna talk to you about chakras and energies and all of that. I don't get that. That's not my cup of tea. But if that's how you can connect with the mystic, then go for it. I myself find much more spiritual connection in understanding my central nervous system, which is why I'm a scientific mystic, which seems like a contradiction, but it's the only way I'm able to experience authentic spirituality.
I don't think that sounds like a contradiction, but that's also my experience.
Well, that's because you're who you are.
So your talk of Christian mysticism, this is something that I have heard more. I've heard the phrasing more and more as I've started listening to different podcasts over the past 4 or 5 months and reading and stuff like that. But I don't really have a solid grasp of it. And I know it's probably not, you know, for today's chat to really delve into it, but I'm curious if you definitely share resources that I could read and that our listeners could read, because I want to have a good idea of where to start, because I'm very intrigued every time I hear about it.
Sure. I will. I'll leave a bunch of them in the show notes. I mean, it goes back as early as Gregory of Nyssa in the 3rd century. And even before that, you could argue, but I mean, it goes well back into Judaism as well.
I was just going to say that Jewish mystical tradition, right? The Merkavah, I mean, they talk about it starting with Elijah, and there's the huge Jewish mystical tradition that starts, you know, 1st-2nd century Common Era, mm-hmm. which is right around the time that you're talking. Because it turns out that unlike this sensory deprivation room that you're talking about, our cultures do not grow in vacuums. And so that there are parallels and similarities coming up at the same time is, I don't believe, a coincidence.
Oh, you know what I should take paragraphs from like medieval Christian mystics and 1st-century Jewish mystics and Muslim mystics and should Sufi. Then just shuffle yeah. them and yeah. then ask you Great which quiz. Religion it is. Because
That's right.
when you get down to these mystical traditions, they all kind of sound very similar. We kind of stop arguing as much because a big part of the mystical experience is a unitive experience. The more connected you are to this deep mystical experience, the more you are uniting, the more you're finding commonality, the less you're concerned about protecting your tribe.
I just wanted to try to give like a couple of themes that maybe it will be helpful for you, Ian, but anyone who also doesn't really understand what it means to talk about Christian mysticism or mysticism in general. And mm-hmm. I think that it's helpful to think about one of the main themes that runs through a lot of the, at least like Christian mystical writings, is apophatic theology. Mm. And apophatic theology just means doing the kind of theology or talking about God in such a way that you recognize there are no positive, and by positive, I just mean substantial things you can say to describe traits of God. So, for example, there is a Christian mystic, Pseudo-Dionysius, who is a writer in the like late 5th, early 6th century. And in his writings, he has on the divine names, I think it is the name of the book. And in that, he goes through this big list of names for God. And it's all kinds of things like light, wisdom, cloud, leaf, creator of ages, and on and on and on and on. And then he says, like, these are all these substantive names that we use to try to capture, like, who God is, what God is. And we use those, but they're totally inadequate. And we have to recognize, like, what names or traits lack. And so the emphasis is on apophatic theology, sometimes also called negative theology. So it's about, like, what God isn't. Whereas a lot of our contemporary traditions, like the churches I grew up in, you talk about God in an anthropomorphic way, or God as having human characteristics. And those are very concrete and set, and you can experience them and see them. Like, that's just the way that we, that people often interact with God or the divine. And that would be cataphatic theology, or positive theology, in the sense that you're actually attributing concrete characteristics to God. So I think it's helpful. That's not everything, obviously, but those are two different ways of operating. And mysticism is very much more attuned to the negative apophatic mode of discussing the divine or God or whatever you want to insert there.
Okay.
Yeah, I would add also that in Judaism, it's a both and. So one of our major thinkers, Maimonides, of the Middle Ages, also known as Rambam, he basically said that concept that I don't know what God is. I can only tell you what God is not. Right? I cannot say that God is all good. I can say that God is not evil. Right? Is how he would, how Maimonides would frame understandings, but then would also give because we are human beings and we are so limited in our intellect. One other word for God that Maimonides used was the great intellect. But because we are not that, we have to use anthropomorphic and anthropopathic ways of describing God, right? That I can relate to God, going back to that B'Tselem Elohim, that concept of that we are all created in the divine likeness. Well, if that's the case, then God also has physical characteristics to me, and emotional characteristics, and relationship characteristics. But that's because of my limitations, not because of God's limitations. And that's how Maimonides clarified both, saying we need, our language is insufficient, but it's all we have. So thank you for those explanations.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think, you know, we also have to be careful when we, you know, we're using broad strokes here in defining a lot of these terms and trying to clarify them for ourselves, and just being conscientious of that.
Oh, yes. We could do another series just on mysticism. We should. That's maybe an entirely other podcast.
There are a couple other quick questions that I'd love to sort of pick at with you folks. And one, and this is going to challenge us, because we're just going to ask for one, which is there a religious stereotype which impacts you that you would like to see dispelled?
Yes.
Okay, Ian. You're up. One.
That all Christians are conservative. That's a stereotype. Great. I see.
Right. Especially here in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Is there one for you, Kendra or Zach, that you would like to dispel?
Yeah, mine is related to the fact that I am a religious studies student. And so that often means, and it's not a stereotype that I think is like super harmful. It's just something that is like a miscommunication or confusion about what it means to study religion. But people often think when I study religion that I am training to be a pastor or clergy of some kind, or that I'm studying to be a theologian, which is a more understandable confusion, especially since I did do a master's in theology, but my PhD is in the scientific study of religion. Those are very different. The disciplinary differences are significant there. But that's an understandable confusion, because if you're outside of that world, you don't know why theology is separate from religious studies. that's one that I tend to see.
Thinking about God, or studying how people think about God.
Yeah, exactly. Because in religious studies, the question about whether God is real or whether some sort of religious doctrine is true or good, it doesn't weigh into the equation in the same way that it would for someone who is training to be a clergy of some kind. And yeah, people in religious studies departments, it's a very multidisciplinary field. So you have anthropologists and sociologists and psychologists, historians, and the questions that they're asking are descriptive and explanatory, but they're not so much evaluative. They can be, but the emphasis is more on trying to understand what is happening, what is the practitioner experiencing, and then how do we explain what that means. And so sometimes people in religious studies departments who, especially in my area, people who are trying to explain religion relying on the sciences can be accused of being too reductionistic. Because if you're trying to explain a religious experience in terms of, you know, psychology, neuroscience, sociology, that can feel to a practitioner of that religion like, oh, you don't think anything I do like is significant to me or whatever. And so that's understandable, but also not something like, even though I seek to use those kinds of explanations to make sense of religion, I don't think that that reduces the significance of those experiences for people. But again, I think it's understandable why people have that hesitation towards anything that smacks of like using science to explain religious experiences, because I think the gut reaction is to think that they're totally reductionistic and that those scholars don't actually care about religion, when in fact a lot of religious studies people are religious in a variety of ways.
That's excellent to try to dispel and elucidate a little bit further what you're actually studying. And so when we approach other people, we don't make those assumptions.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like to add, Zach?
I'm having a hard time putting a name to it, but it's no mystery that Christianity has done a lot of harm in the world. A lot of good, you know, well, we're not all bad, but there are historically a lot of people who have been disenfranchised or abused by the church and by leaders in the church. Specifically, and myself being a leader of the church, there is just a general unease around me that I hate. I'm just such a casual person, such a down-to-earth kind of open book, what you see is what you get kind of a person, and I don't like power distances, but there still exists this distance where if somebody is a very religious person, they will see me as higher than them, and therefore creating a barrier in between us. And if somebody is very anti-religious because of whatever experience they've had, they will put me further down and away and not open up or change the way that they are around me. And so
In either case, you're still at arm's length.
It is a very lonely profession because people have these preconceived notions about what pastors are. And because of the role that we've played in society for so many thousands of years, and it's not unwarranted, it's just unfortunate. And I work really hard to try to dispel that.
I think this is one way that you're able to do that.
I hope so.
I agree. Yeah. But I know how I get what you're saying, because I'll be honest that I tend to have that initial feeling of angst and the need to put up some sort of barrier to myself and someone who I meet for the first time, and I find out that they are a religious leader in some way.
One time I forgot my sermon, and when it came time for the sermon time, I thought, well, okay, so I can pretend like I have it all together and I can try to just give this from memory, or I can just admit it. And so I said, well, everyone, talk amongst yourselves for a while. I need to go print out my sermon because I completely forgot about it. And so I ran, and when I came back, somebody said to me in the receiving line, Pastor Zach, I just love how much of a screw-up you are, because it makes me feel so good about myself, and it makes me feel so comfortable around you, knowing that you mess up all the time.
How beautiful.
And I said, well, on one hand, thank you. On the other hand, man.
Yeah.
Can I be accessible without being a screw-up?
It's a real backhanded compliment.
But hey, I'll take what I can get.
But I like that, though. I like the genuineness. I think that's the reason why we all get along so well, is because we're all very genuine people. And that's why I knew going into Sinai and Synapses and going into the fellowship 2 years ago, that I didn't necessarily need to put up the standard barrier, imaginative barrier that I usually put up, because I knew we were all, you know, handpicked for a really fascinating experience. So with Sinai and Synapses, I didn't feel that. But I still, to this day, and if I meet someone new and find out that they are either a leader, religious leader, or just, you know, some sort of lay leader heavily involved in their church, I initially have that sense of angst, just because of the times in the past that I've been judged because of my views on science and religion.
Well, on behalf of all other clergy, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
We kind of joke here at the synagogue about, so we do a quick prayer over a grape product, like wine or grape juice. And, you know, I'm there kind of in the middle and I hold up the cup, and invariably, if you ever see this, and it's not just the synagogue, it's every synagogue I've ever attended, there is easily 10 to 15 feet between the rabbi and the next closest person. Easily 10 to 15 feet away, because there is that mental barrier acts itself out in a very physical way. Mm-hmm.
But what other stereotypes have affected you? I don't think you've shared.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the reason I didn't share at that moment is because I don't think I could stick to my rule.
What rule is that?
Of just one?
Of one.
Ah.
Well,
last week we talked about not having horns.
True. True.
So we got that one out of the way.
Yeah. Phew. I think if I choose one today, it's going to be that there is not one flavor of Judaism. And what's going through my head right now is both Baskin Robbins and Anne DeFranco, 32 flavors and then some. So there's not one flavor. What our commonality is that we're a tribe, in that, so we're a peoplehood. And we also have a religion. So there's lots of cultures, lots of mixed cultures, that when you say something like, oh, you don't look Jewish, is hurtful in so many ways because I don't know what a Jew looks like.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting.
Right. But that's one piece that we come in lots of different flavors. And so not all rabbis have beards, hashtag. Not all Jews keep the Sabbath. That concept that we can't be stereotyped as a lump group, that depending who you ask, because it is a very complex question of who counts as a Jew, there's in the neighborhood of 15 million Jews in the world, which is a teeny tiny number, right? That's like the size of Metro New York City, or it's smaller than Metro Mexico City. Like, we are not a big group, and yet, so that's the other part, right? That there's so few of us, and yet we seem to be known more than our numbers might warrant. And even within those small worldwide numbers, there are so many differences. And I think that would be the stereotype to dispel today. Zach, I'm going to leave this in your very capable hands.
Okay.
In that I have a story that you can choose to use or not use. But I will give you the story and then you can work it in or not. Does that sound okay?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. So here's the story. It is told that in every generation, there are times when hope threatens to leave this world. At such times, the Baal Shem Tov, the great Jewish mystic, would go into a secret place in the forest. There he would light a special fire, say a holy prayer, seeking the long-forgotten sacred name of God. The danger was averted and hope stayed alive. Later, when his disciple would go to the same place in the forest and say, "Master of the universe, I do not know how to light a fire, but I can say the prayer." Again, danger was averted and hope stayed alive. And still later, his disciple would go to the same place in the forest and say, "Master of the universe, I do not know how to light a fire or say the prayer, but I found my way to this place, and that must be enough." And it was. Hope stayed alive. And later, when yet another disciple was needing help for hope, he sat in his chair with his head in his hands and said, "Master of the universe, I no longer know how to light a fire nor say the prayer. I can't even find our way to that place, but I can tell the story. And that must be enough." And it was. And it still is. As long as stories are told, hope stays alive in our world.
This has been episode 3 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. If you like what you hear, tell your friends and leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. Check us out at downthewormhole.com for show notes and links to all our social media goodness. Next week, we're starting a new mini-series on this conflict we keep talking about, when it started, why it started, and what can be done to bring us back together. It's our hope that these conversations will help you to have more constructive dialogue in your own lives, so
you end up somewhere that's really beautiful and new and open, and it's not a horror movie. Like, you get to go back through the door if you really want to, so don't worry about that.